Welcome in to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. You know, we have two camps in this weird, weird world. We have the camp of faith that tells you when it's your time to go, because in this weird story of life, you have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And in the end of our story, you have that camp of faith that tells you if you're secure in your faith, you know where it is you're going, you shouldn't have to worry. Don't worry about where it is you're going. Then you have that camp of skepticism that says, well, you are going to buy the farm, but do you really know where it is you're going? And maybe you should ask more questions. But there is a third camp. There's that third camp that tells you, I know where I'm going because I've been there. I've had that rare near-death experience. Today's guest, Jim Willis, has written a book on the quintessential near-death experience. It's called Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys and Revelations. Now, most books on near-death experiences are just a compilation, or it's one person's journey with a near-death experience. And while they are fascinating, the actual journeys themselves, and they teach us through the experience, Jim has gone above and beyond. He's delved into the origins of the near-death experience, the experiments with near-death experience. He gives you the scientific side, the skeptical side. He gives you the biblical side, the faith side of near-death experiences. And we even delve into the meaning of life, which is very interesting. So I am excited to get Jim Willis on this program. Let's not delay. Let's bring him in. Jim Willis earned his master's degree in theology from Andover Newton Theological School, and he has been an ordained minister for over 40 years. He's also taught college courses in comparative religion and cross-cultural studies. His background in theology and education led to his writing more than 20 books on history, religion, the apocalypse, cross-cultural spirituality, and the mysteries of the unknown. His books include Visible Ink Press's Censoring God, Ancient Gods, Hidden History, and American Cults. He lives in the woods of South Carolina, where he's joining us now. Let's bring him into Darkness Radio. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm fine, Tim. Good to be with you. Boy, thanks for that introduction. You make me sound interesting. I appreciate it.
You certainly are, sir. You certainly are. And you know what? You've written one heck of an interesting book. I'll give you that.
You know, this is a book that goes back 50 years.
Yeah.
When I was young and right out of school, and I was a ordained pastor of my first church, and you know, like all of us in our 20s, I knew all the answers, you know. And I look back on those days and I thought, oh, Jim, how can you be so naive? How could that have ever been you? You know, I used to preach about all this, you know, in the early days of Christianity. I was on the very conservative side. I moved quite a way since then, but that's where I was. And as a result, I used to preach about, you know, angelic beings and sing Hark the Herald Angels Sing and all this kind of thing.
Sure.
And like all of us in our 20s, I knew all the answers, mm-hmm. you know, and I knew all the scientific stuff. And so I guess I was a believer in heaven or afterlife, but I was more like a hoper, I think, than a believer. It was the kind of thing that I used to say it and believe it in my mind, but it wasn't part of my soul. And at that time, 50 years ago, I was invited to a hospital room where a member of my church, an old woman in the book, I call her Hannah, mm-hmm. a wonderful, dear old lady. She was just so sharp. And I was told by the nurses when I went in to see her that this is probably the last time you'll see her. She's, mm-hmm. you know, I mean probably that last stop. I mean, she's not going to come out of the hospital, obviously.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, well, what can I do? Well, I knew that Hannah liked the old hymns of the church. And so I got in the habit when I went to see her every day, I got in the habit of taking my guitar along and playing some music and singing, oh, the old Rugged Cross and In the Garden and all those things. And Hannah liked it. Sometimes the nurses would wheel other patients into the room in their beds so they could join in. We had a little choir going and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was fun. on. But on this particular day, which was the last time I saw Hannah alive, I happened to be by myself in the room, and I had sung a hymn for her, and we had talked and we'd prayed, and I put the guitar away. While I was putting the guitar away, she said, who'd you bring with you this time? And I said, what? She said, yeah, they always come. I think the music attracts them. Well, I never stopped to think, you know, music is vibration, right?
Right.
And vibration is energy. And what was going on? And then she looked right through me. She looked so wise. She says, oh, I know, they're staying outside. Sometimes they wait until you leave before they come in through the portal. And I said, portal? You know, I mean, this was 50 years ago, but portal? And so I looked around, and I knew, I looked toward the door to her room, you know, and I didn't see anybody out there. And she said, yeah, they're waiting outside now. And I said, well, what happens? Well, sometimes when you leave, they, you know, they come in, and it's always so comforting to have them here. And I, you know, she was an old lady, and I didn't want to make her feel bad, you know, but I thought she was crazy. I mean, I had all the scientific, the brain was shutting down, the blood wasn't throwing, and the neurons weren't fire, all that kind of stuff. So I said, well, Hannah, I'll see you next time. And I put my guitar away, but I stopped by the nurse's station on the way out. And I said, what was Hannah talking about, people coming to see her through a portal? And the nurse, again, 50 years ago, mm-hmm. when before hospitals began to accept this kind of thing, she said, oh, she's been talking like that the last couple of days. I think she's probably close to the end. And I said, okay. Well, I got a call that night. Hannah passed away during the night. And she had asked me to do her funeral. So 3-4 days later, I was there with the guitar, and I was in the funeral home, and I told some stories, and I played the guitar and everything else. But I couldn't help get that look in her eye, the portal, and the people waiting on the other side of the portal who were drawn by the vibration, the music. And I'm ashamed to say that it took 50 years before I really began to put that stuff together. 50 years of being by the bedside of a lot of people who died and some who came back. And 50 years of hearing these stories about seeing loved ones and seeing a bright light and all that kind of stuff. Well, after I had retired from ministry, which was now about 16 years ago, I guess.
Sure.
When I retired, I had come out and deliberately to live in the woods. My plan was to live out here in the middle of the woods for 1 year and go on a retreat, because it's a deep, dark secret, but ministers usually don't have time to be contemplative and to enter into these communities of spiritual growth. You're a CEO of a small company called a church, and mm-hmm. you got to worry about budgets, and you got to worry about buildings, and you got to worry about growth, and you got to worry about church services. And of course, I was a college professor too, so I had to worry about getting my next lecture ready and all this kind of stuff. And 50 years of that, and I just had been talking about and talking about and talking about, and I wasn't experiencing. So when I came out here to the woods, it was to experience the other side. By then I had stopped calling it just God. I didn't have any trouble with the word God, but so many people have weird concepts of God that when I say the word God, they think I'm talking about the God that they're thinking of, you know?
Yeah.
So I just came out to experience. I said, oh, okay, God, you know, it's you and me 24 hours a day. And I will not let you go until you bless me, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, my prayer was answered. There's no question about it. It didn't come to me through Christianity. It came, my experience with the other side came really through probably the world's oldest religion, which was shamanism. But at any rate, I was, you know, thinking about that. In 50 years, I never got rid of Hannah's thing about the portal. Well, some of my old parishioners came to visit me just a couple of years ago. And the man whose name was Bob told me that his mother had just passed away, and they were there for her. And they were there for her passing. And his mother was another good friend. She reminded me of Hannah a lot. Loved the old hymns, and mm-hmm. I used to sing in the garden with her and all this kind of thing. And I said, well, what was it like when she passed? And he said, it was really strange. She asked who I had brought with me. I've sung this song before, maybe in a different key, but I know this song. Who did you bring with you? She said. And he said, no, Mom, I'm here alone. Oh, they come through the portal sometimes. And she used that word portal again. And I heard it and something just went off. And two incidents that happened 50 years apart were cemented in my mind. These two women had seen something and they described it as a portal. And they saw people on the other side who were brought through a vibrational influence and through music, and in this case. And they had seen something. And I began to just absolutely kick myself for the opportunities I had missed over the last 50 years to really question these folks. I was their pastor. I was going to help them. I think they could have helped me a lot more if I had let them. And of course, by this time, I had also experienced out-of-body experiences myself, which I think are very well, very much connected with near-death experiences. Mm-hmm. And so I had been over to the other side. I had seen the other side, you know. I just no longer, it was no longer, I doubted at all that there was something waiting right there just outside the perception fence here in the material world, our five senses of perception. And so when a friend of mine, whose name was Joe, had a near-death experience, that was the one that kicked it off. I said, I've got to write this book. And I wrote to Visible Inc. And they said, yeah, by all means, go ahead and do it. And Joe had a vivid out-of-body experience. He worked in a hospital himself, a very technical job. I asked him once what he did, and he said, you know, all those, the joints they're putting in, shoulders and hips and knees, and they're all made out of plastic and stuff. And I said, yeah. He says, well, my job is make sure there are no parts left over.
Oh, my gosh. Said,
okay, that's a good thing. So Joe was working. As a matter of fact, he was actually pushing a person toward the OR that he was going to be there with, who was having a knee replacement, and Joe had a heart attack.
Oh.
And if you're going to have a heart attack, you might as well have it in a fully equipped hospital surrounded by specialists who you know.
Right.
And they immediately got Joe into the OR, and they saw that he had to have a triple bypass. And the operation went fine, but when they were all done, Joe couldn't breathe. And he flatlined. And his friend who was working the tube that went down his breathing tube just felt somehow that tube was blocked. And so he just manually reached in and pulled the tube right out. And Joe breathed his first breath. And he said, man, we had lost you. We were gone. And Joe said, yeah, but I know where I went. And Joe had this vivid out-of-body experience. And it was all of the classic stuff. I mean, it was, he had the vision of the tunnel and the seeing his body from above and looking down on it, going through the tunnel toward the light and the vision of light on the other side, which Joe, being Christian, interpreted as being Jesus. Mm-hmm. If he had been Jewish, it might have been Moses, or Hindu, it might have been Krishna. You know, I mean, we see what we have been kind of trained in our life.
Yeah.
But he had that vision, and he saw his father as a young man, who Joe never saw his father as a young man. Mm-hmm. His father had died when Joe was fairly young. And when he came back and told me the story, I mean, Joe was just a, he wasn't a mystic, or he wasn't a crazy guy. He was a man's man. He liked to hunt and fish, and had a lot of friends, and he joked around a lot, and he's a big guy, and he's strong, and he loved his family. He loved his kids. And when I went to visit him at his home a couple of days after he got out of the hospital, I could tell he wanted to tell me the story. His mother-in-law was there at the kitchen table with us when the three of us sat having a cup of coffee. And he said, I hesitate to tell you this, John. I don't want you to think I'm crazy. I said, no, go ahead. And he told me this story, and that his story winds up in the last couple of chapters of the book, because it sums up everything that the book was about. And so that's how this book came about. It began 50 years ago and was connected through another woman's death and then through Joe's out-of-body experience, plus all the stuff in between. And it was, I've got to say, it was a joy to write. The book before this one that I wrote was called American Cults, and I was just steeped in darkness for 6 or 8 months, you know, American cult life. But this book was liberating. It was just so many wonderful stories and so many great visions and so affirming that it was just a joy.
Let me take you off track for a second. For a pastor for so long, what took you off the beaten path and went into darkness for that long to write a book about cults?
Well, I hate to say it. when a publisher calls you up and says, we want a book about American cults, and here's your advance if you want to do it. money talks, you know?
I guess so, right?
And they thought that I would be able to do it, because being a pastor for so many times, I had been so much involved with cults that they thought I might be able to, you know, I mean, everything from Waco to, you know, Jim Jones. And didn't sure. help any that it, when I was in my height and my golden years as a pastor, Jim Jones and Jim Baker mm-hmm. and Jim Swaggart and all those ministers named Jim were all having troubles. So that's where the cult book came from.
Well, there you go. That's an honest and an upfront answer. So getting back to the phenomena of near-death experiences, and I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit and then we'll backtrack here, but one of the interesting things I found in the book, one of the things that jumped out at me, it's not the first time I've heard it, Jim, but it is one of the things that stuck out to me. It's the line in the book that says, sometimes the near-death experience you have is the one that you believe in, or the one that you believe you're about to have, and it's based on faith.
Yeah.
And that gets the mind racing. It gets you thinking, yeah. Oh my gosh, what do I believe?
Yeah. Yeah. And what condition
yes.
do I want to be in when I die?
Mm-hmm.
And what bothers me about that is that the American way of death is actually, I think, the wrong way to go about it. When people die nowadays, it's totally different than it was 50 years ago. In the old days, a lot of times people died in the comfort of their own home, mm-hmm. laying in their own bed, surrounded by their own family. And the family was there and they felt comforted and they felt part of something. And it was natural.
Yeah.
Nowadays, we take people past that. We want to keep them alive as long as possible, but we don't think about what kind of a life they're leading. And so when I go to visit people, and toward the last, this is one of the things, frankly, that just made me decide to leave the ministry. I just couldn't handle it anymore. I'd go into a hospital room and see this poor person who'd be hooked up to oxygen tubes and intravenous feeders and lights going on and stuff and all this weird hospital noises and antiseptic this, and family couldn't even come all the time. You know, they had to usually spend, and it was just, it seemed to be, a lot of times they were drugged up.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really didn't know what they were doing. My own father was this way, you know. He was a great man of faith, but he died the death that he feared in a hospital room like this. And it just felt to me that something was wrong. Yes, we can prolong life past the time when it used to be over. But is that necessarily always a good thing? I just don't think so. And so I began to think about this in this book, that if death is a natural part of life, and certainly it is, even though in the American way of death, I mean, I'm amazed at the number of youth group kids I had that were in their teens and college, and they'd never even seen a dead body.
Yeah.
You know, the parents thought, oh, that was terrible. I don't want to, you know, expose him to that. And it was it's just a terrible thing. We've made death into an enemy.
It's the boogeyman.
Yeah. And death is going to win in the end. I don't care who you are. It's going to win. One night at about 3 o'clock in the morning, my telephone rang. This is some years ago. My telephone rang, and it was a nurse from our local hospital. And she said, Jim, can you get down to the hospital? I know it's 3 o'clock in the morning, but, and she told me who was in the hospital. And she said, he might not make it through the night, and he's been asking for you. And I said, oh, of course. I got out of bed, put on my clothes, and got in my car and went right to the hospital. And I walked in, and there was my friend Bradley. Brad was a deacon in the church. He was a pillar of the community. He had two doctorates. He had started a university that's still going to this day. A very, very sharp man. Everybody wow. liked him. He was just, if anybody had lived a successful life, it was Brad. If you wanted to look up the definition of successful life in the dictionary, there's Brad's picture coming back at you. He had made a small fortune that he had given away to the community and stuff like this. And he had, founded all these things. Just a great guy. And I walked in, and he and I were friendly enough by this time, we knew each other, that I didn't need to pull any punches. And I said, Brad, they tell me this might be it. Are you ready to go? And Brad started to cry. And I said, you okay? And he said, Jim, he said, I can't kid you. He said, I've done a lot. I know I've had a successful life. And, I've got the thank you cards and all that kind of stuff to prove it, students and all that kind of stuff. But he said, there's one thing in life that I never did that I miss more than anything else. I said, what was that? He said, I never prepared for this moment. Whoa, that just absolutely wiped me out. So I sat there with him. And thank goodness he didn't die that night. Matter of fact, he made it 10 more days before he died.
Oh, wow.
And in those 10 days, I was with him every day for a good, sometimes an hour, sometimes more. And we talked. We talked philosophy. We talked spirituality. We talked about consciousness. We talked about foreign, different religions and everything else. And by the end of those 10 days, Bradley seemed a lot more ready. And yet I can honestly say, I don't know if I taught him anything, but boy, he sure taught me a lot in those last 10 days. And I'm afraid that that is probably the case with most people in our culture today, in our Western culture. We're just not prepared. We don't get ready. We somehow think it's morbid to even talk about it. And so I wanted to write a book that was positive and that was uplifting. And of course, that was when your death experience came. At the same time, I wanted to take death and spirituality out of the woo-woo supernatural place. Now, there's no doubt about it. To us on this side of the material fence, it is a supernatural thing, because supernatural means above the natural,
right,
or metaphysical, you know?
Yeah.
And so it is that. But on the other hand, I'm sure that death, and I have come to believe this more than anything since I wrote the book, death follows certain rules, certain laws that are a part of it. And there is a science behind it. Now, I don't think it's a science that can be understood by our kind of science. I think our intellectualizing all this kind of stuff doesn't really do any good.
No.
Any intellectualizing in your brain doesn't do anything to your heart, or your central oneness. But if it's real and if it's that, then I wanted to bring that into this, because I'm absolutely convinced that if we could start living a life that is meaningful, and one way to do that is to get past this idea that death is an enemy to be feared. If we can start looking to that end, and we can start peering over that sensory fence that through which we perceive the world, then maybe we can stop some of this nonsense that we're doing. Maybe we can say this is more important than the wars and the pollution and the fighting and the infighting and all the politics and all of that stuff. That is so real that it can change our lives. And I've never known anybody who's been over on the other side and come back who didn't come back with a message that was positive and uplifting and that this world really needs to hear, I think, more than anything else.
Right, exactly. Yeah. The message has always been one of love. It's always been one that's been uplifting. It's always been one that's overreaching of anything that's material or anything that we're absorbed in on this earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never known one person to have a near-death experience that said, I wanted to come back from it. They always wanted to stay on the other side. And I can understand that. In out-of-body experiences, some out-of-body experiences that I have had, the colors are so vivid, and the sense of comfort and acceptance is so good, and it's so real, and the sense of love, and just the absence of problems, the absence of worry. It's so wonderful that there are times I haven't wanted to come back either. I just want to say, I want to stay here. But something communicates with you and says, you're not done yet, so you have to come back. And I still have yet to find one person who didn't want to come back from an after-death experience. Now, I've read some stories of people who have had some bad experiences. Yes.
I was going to say, and maybe this is a time for us to take a break, Jim, because when we come back, I do want to tackle negative NDEs.
Good. Yeah.
And some of the people who have come back and said, wait a minute, there is something on that other side that isn't so good.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to talk about that when we come back. The name of the book is Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys and Revelations. And folks, if you're at one of those points in life where whether you're rock solid in your faith and you know where you're going, or you're skeptical and you don't know exactly where you're going, or you're cynical and maybe you're an atheist and you say, I think I'm worm food at the end, I think maybe you should pick up this book. And either way, read this book, because it attacks things from all sides. And really, it's self-assuring. You know, I've got an interesting story at the end of the show where it's interesting that no matter where you are in life, Jim's book has really taken an all-encompassing look at the death experience. And as he put it eloquently at the beginning, or at this first part of the show, he's really taken the supernatural out of this and looked at it as a regular experience and a part of our lives, because there is an end to the story, much like this book. So I encourage you to go get it right now during the break. Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys and Revelations. When we come back, we'll talk about the not-so-positive side of NDEs, the negative experiences that people have had when they've taken that journey. When we come back with Jim Willis right here on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting, this is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Our guest is Jim Willis. The new book is Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys and Revelations. Before the break, Jim, we were talking about near-death experiences, of course, and we were talking about some of the wonderful ones that people have had, some of the beginnings to their journey to the other side, some of the things they have seen. One of the interesting things in the book is that there have been some people when they go to take that journey that, you know, they think that maybe they haven't led such a good life. And when they've taken those few steps into the great beyond, there's some not so great things that are waiting there for them. It's not the majority of the near-death experience, in general, but it does happen, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And I struggled with this. I'm really glad you brought it up, Tim, because I struggled with this. Should there be any fear and all this kind of thing? One part of the near-death experience that everybody reports on is what is often called a life review. Their life passes in front of their eyes, and they see it as a block. It doesn't happen point by point by point, incident after incident. They see it as a block, and they come to understand how it all comes together. It's said that when the Buddha was underneath the Bo tree and he had his enlightenment, moment of enlightenment, he saw all of his previous lives in a moment of time and came to understand how they led him to this place. And I began to think that that's probably what happens to us. Here we are so used to, however long we live, we are so used to living, as I said before, within that perception fence. If we experience the world by tasting it and talking and hearing and feeling and smelling and all this kind of stuff. And that's a fence that keeps too much information from coming to us at one point, which is probably good. Mm-hmm. But it also makes it so that we can't get out. And on this side, we are taught a lot of garbage in this life. Some of it from school, and I'm a school teacher. Some of it from church, and I was a pastor. Mm-hmm. Some of it from our parents. And yeah, I've been a parent too. We're taught all this stuff. So we have all these ideas jumbled up in our heads and all these expectations. And I think that it is possible. I've come to the conclusion, in my own self at least, that I think it's possible that some of these people who have had bad experiences and come back from them experience that for a reason. Because I've read the stories of some people who have had these bad experiences, and they said, I realized right away my life's got to change. Well, that's a pretty good thing to know, right? You know, to get you. I wish it had happened to Adolf Hitler, you know. Maybe right. It did. I don't know. Right. Who knows? Yeah. Who can say? Yeah. But I do know that we come over, we seem to come into this life, the energy sense of who we are, comes into this life. And as we pass through the Higgs field, we take on mass. And that's the physical world that surrounds us. And here in this energy field, we do something that we can't do on the other side. If the other side, the source from which we come, is perfect goodness and perfect unity and perfect wholeness, that's a wonderful thing. But we can't grow there. Because the only way to get growth is to have individual experiences. Mm-hmm. So we come into this life, and this life becomes a school for us. And we have these experiences, and we gather them all up. And I think one of the things that happens during that life review at the end of our life, which I think we'll all have, is that we take all of these experiences and deposit them, so to speak, in what sometimes has been called the Akashic Library or the Akashic Records. And in a sense, we are doing something here that we can't do there, and it involves ego. It involves our sense of individuality. And so when some people die, they still have that residue in their minds. And if they are worried, and if they are nervous, and if they have been taught that you could be, you know, tortured forever by a loving God, never could figure that out.
No, I can't either.
At any rate, you know, if they're taught that, and if they're so afraid of it, then it I think it can influence you, because I think in the moments after we die, we carry with us, and when we leave this body, we carry with us all of those experiences that we've had in life. And I think that's a protection in a way, because if we were to go directly from this life to that next life, it would be such a shock. I'm not sure we could handle it. We'd be dazed. And so I've got a sneaking suspicion we carry this baggage with us, and we gradually shed it. And I never really quite understood how this worked until I had my first experience. I've had three of them now. My first experience of actually going in an out-of-body experience and doing the work of what is called a psychopomp, and that's helping somebody cross over. The first time this happened, it was about three or four out-of-body experiences that I had, that I met this woman who was not having, she wasn't being punished or anything like that. She was in a sense of grayness. And I got the idea that she had somehow so identified with this life that she had been caught in it and couldn't give it up. And I have no idea how long this went on. It turns out that she was German. Matter of fact, I even know her name, Sarah Heinz, H-E-I-N-Z.
Really?
And I was able to find a little about her. And I was able to actually help her shed that and go on toward the light. So she wasn't having a negative experience. It was just not a positive one. You know, it was just kind of neutral. Mm-hmm. Now, since then, at the Monroe Institute, where I studied out-of-body experiences with William Monroe, with William Buhlmann, rather, they have now a whole course up there at the Institute where they teach people how to do this. And they've had wonderful examples of somehow finding somebody, helping them through, and then coming back and actually looking into the records and finding their social security number, finding out where they lived, finding out what their name was, and all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
And verifying the records. So it's actually bringing science into it. It isn't just an intuitive, you know, la-la kind of thing. I mean, they actually find the living records of the people who they helped. So I think when people have these bad experiences, it serves as a wake-up call. And what that means, it was really a good experience.
Yeah.
So the fact that you had a bad experience, or you've heard of somebody who had a bad experience who came back, it probably is a good thing, because it makes us say, I don't want to be that way. I want to focus on the positive, and I want to live my life that way. And sometimes it takes that kind of a jolt, you know, to really get us to come back.
Kind of to add to your point, I kind of look at a bad NDE kind of like we're all in school here, right, on this earth. We're all having an experience like school. To be human is to be imperfect. You have to be imperfect. If the soul and heaven and God are perfect, right,
mm-hmm.
we have to be imperfect in order to learn, right? Okay, so we're all in school. We're all imperfect. We're all learning our lesson. When we go home to heaven, we, mm-hmm. you know, we're taking our time off away from school. We keep coming back to learn the lessons. And sometimes mm-hmm. you got to go sit in the principal's office if you're, you know, make a mistake. And if you're making your mistake,
great.
Right?
That's a great metaphor, Tim. I love that.
There you go.
Yeah, sometimes we're called to the principal's office.
There you go.
But, you know, that gives me a lot of comfort. You know, people say, well, now that you're not practicing Christianity anymore, I mean, I haven't set foot in church for 16 years. But they said, now that you're not pregnant, do you feel like you've lost your faith? And I said, no, I've gained it, because I understand that even when times are bad, and even when difficult things are happening, when I'm really sick, or when my heart is acting up, or something like that, or when I sprain a finger,
which I've done, yeah,
falling, I realized that happened for a purpose. That was one of the experiences that I came here to get. And so rather than just trying to say, oh, life is only good when you get rid of the bad and you can just keep the good around you, get your insurance policies going and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Rather than say that, I say, no, life consists of it all. And even the bad experiences can be turned into a positive if we understood that we volunteered for it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I used to be, I used to run marathons and I used to run triathlons. And there were times halfway through the race, I'd find myself just saying, why am I doing this? And I volunteered for it, you know. But at the end, I was always so glad that I kept going. And that's what kind of like, you know, life is a marathon. And
yeah.
There's hills. And sometimes we just have to accept that. And that, to me, gives me a great deal of confidence, gives me a great deal of faith.
You know, those times of adversity do give you faith. And you just have to decide what it is you're putting your faith into. Is that fair?
Yeah. 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 I think one of the most comforting words in the English language is the word through.
Mm-hmm.
We went through it all.
Yeah, through it all.
And in the going through it all, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's pleasant and happy. But at the end, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right?
That's right.
and eventually it kills you, and that's a good thing too. So
I want to get back to something you said earlier, and I do find that at the end of this book, no spoilers here, but I find at the end of this book you do a remarkable job of getting people ready for the end. And we had talked about preparing people for the end. There's an end to our story. There's mm-hmm. It's inevitable. You know, they say there's two things in life that's inevitable, death and taxes. Well, there's always an end to every story. And we have made death the boogeyman. And I don't know what it is, if it's it's because society's become more vain, if it's because, you know, we become more material, if it's the fact that we've put more emphasis on the here and now and living in the moment than we have thinking about the totality of what it is we do in life. If we've put too much emphasis on wanting to be young and not focused on everything in this life or what it is, I don't know. I'm getting into a lot of psychobabble here, Jim.
No, I don't think so.
But what is it? Why is it that we haven't said to ourselves, you know what? Death is natural. Why have we not said to ourselves, let's not push it off to the side. Let's not sweep it under the rug. Let's talk about it. Why are we not talking more about it and making it more natural?
You began this by saying nothing is inevitable except death and taxes. And I'm glad to announce I have something to say about that too. When you're old in life and you've never had much Social Security because you're a minister, become an author. You make so little money, you don't need to pay taxes. So that's not inevitable.
There you go. Another nugget from
it. But death, that's for sure. Yeah. I think we are living at an exciting time because I think that on one hand, the spiritual side, the intuitive side, for thousands of years has said that there's something beyond us and that there's another way and that is waiting for us and that can be great. But I think we're living in an age now where even the scientific side is starting to realize that. We're starting to get physicists, quantum physicists, for instance, starting to talk about death and dimensions and reality in a totally different way. And they're beginning to understand through mathematics, they're beginning to describe a world which has been available to rishis and gurus and monks and priests and stuff for and common people who just meditate. For generations upon generations, they're coming together. In 1957, for instance, Hugh Everett gave us the many worlds idea. And back in 57, people were not willing to accept it. But basically, the whole idea was that the possibilities collapse into every possible universe. You flip a coin and it comes up heads and you say, well, there, it came up heads, therefore it didn't come up tails. But what Hugh Everett said back in 1957 was, no, you flip a coin and all of a sudden the universe splits. In one world, it is heads, and that's the only one you've experienced. So you say, oh, came up heads. There is another you, a doppelganger in a universe, in a dimension right next, who said, it came up tails, and that's the only one that he's experienced. So that's it. Well, Hugh Everett was blacklisted for this. He was knocked out of physics. He couldn't get a job. Eventually had to go and work for the government. But he was brilliant. And now his ideas of the many worlds theories are starting to filter down and people are starting to say, oh, he was right. Time and space, Einstein gives us the idea of the connection of the two. And we understand that given an infinite space, but a finite number of molecules or particles within that space, things are going to be repeated. So anything that can happen eventually in time and space, it will happen. It will coalesce in a different way. Richard Feynman had the sum over paths theory that a lot of people had trouble following, but basically it said that pretend you're a particle making its way through the woods, and a particle can only follow one path at a time. But a particle is also a wave and it spreads out. So therefore particles will overlap other paths and it'll all kind of like, you know, blend together. And they're all talking about these different dimensions. I think what they're all talking about, all these brilliant physicists through their mathematics, what they're saying is that we live within that sensory fence and it is possible to kind of peek over and see on the other side. What we see is all real, but I use that word real with a small lowercase r.
Yeah.
It is not reality. What we call real, there are other dimensions that call real, and other dimensions that call real, and other and all of those reals with a small r coalesce into one reality. And it's possible for us, even in this body, through different techniques, and one of them is a near-death experience, mm-hmm. or out-of-body experience, to peek over that fence and see the greater reality. And I think when people come back from a near-death experience, they're talking about the greater reality. Now, a lot of them times they're frustrated. They can't find the words to describe it, because words are made to describe things on this side of the fence. They've looked over the fence and it doesn't come. They'll even talk about receiving a block of teaching rather than certain truths, you know, that come in. And so I think I just find that very, very comforting, that when we look at death and realize it's a part of reality, and it helps us escape this real with a small r, and we return to the reality, which was with the large, the big R, uppercase R. I just find that to be a really exciting thing. And I hope, you know, if people who read the book can get some sense of that, because boy, it'll cheer your life up, especially when you're down.
Absolutely. And if you ever have the general layman out there who thinks, oh, I don't know that these physicists are actually talking my language, think of one thing, Jim, and that's this one thing here. Right now, CERN is trying to recreate the Big Bang and is actually trying to farm dark matter by smashing different particles together. Mm-hmm. When they do that, ask yourself if it makes you nervous or not. If it makes you nervous, you're on the same wavelength as these physicists are.
Absolutely.
Because there's theories out there with CERN that by doing this, they're going to open up different portals and alternate realities and things like that. And there are people that are driven nuts by it.
And who knows that the reality we're living in was not created by some CERN scientist in a different reality, you know?
That's right.
Created this bubble, and here we are. We're all in these little bubbles, and the infinite amount and infinite space, infinite dimensions. To me, that's exciting.
Yeah.
It certainly takes away our sense of ego. I mean, anything we do, how can it possibly be so important? You know, it could be more important than this. And the whole idea of living in a black hole, or living in these on these brains or membranes, you know, with brain theory and all this kind of stuff, and the whole idea of us possibly even being a program in some future geek's computer, you know, and we're pixels on a screen, you know, that makes perfect sense too. It takes away that sense of, oh, I am so important. That's right. For sure.
Right.
Because in the great scheme of things, yeah, we are important. We're part of the source, you know, but in another sense, no, not so much. I love the idea, the Hindu idea of Brahman and Atman. Brahman is the God, or whatever you want to say, the essence that cannot be explained. Mm-hmm. If you've tried to explain Brahman, if you try to put him in, you know, fence him in with words, you've missed it. You can't possibly find words. The tongue cannot touch it. And yet they also have the concept of Atman within us, that spirit, that spiritual within us that connects us. As a matter of fact, the Hindu Rishi 6,000 years ago made the great thing, thou art that. Brahman and Atman are one. Brahman is the essential that we cannot explain, but that same Brahman is within us, Atman. We are one with that. Oh, that just keeps me up nights. You know, love it. Yeah. I just absolutely love it.
Yeah.
That we are, so in that sense, yeah, we are important.
Yeah.
But in another sense, is there anything that any of us do that is really that important in life that it means we have to lose sleep over it and all this kind of stuff? We do, but,
right.
but do we need to? You know, and it takes away the ego, and it takes away the sense of, oh, if people could really grasp this, I don't think we'd have that great, those great divides between left and right and rich and poor and men and women and all this kind of stuff. We're all one. We're all entangled. We're all connected. Why don't we start acting like it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. The one thing that I did want to broach with you too on this, you know, you've tackled the religious side, you tackle the scientific side, and you do a wonderful job at that. I mean, you tackle everything from thermodynamics to parallel dimensions in this book. You tackle different religions and how they tackle. One of the things I love that you tackle in this book is you tackle how theology tackled Socrates and how they tackled life and death and shared death experiences is one of the things I want to tackle before we leave people today.
Oh, yes.
And the phenomenon of shared death experience.
I've had one of these or maybe two of these, and other people that I've talked to have experienced it too. The term comes from Raymond Moody.
Yeah.
Raymond Moody gave us the original term, near-death experience, back in 1975 in his book, Life After Life. But recently he has been interested in the idea of not near-death experience, but shared death experience. And what that means is it's the experience that is quite common now that people are talking about it. You'll be standing around, say, a bedside of someone who's dying, and the person who's dying will catch a glimpse of a relative or catch a glimpse of a light or a some kind of spiritual being. And for one moment, the people around that bedside, many of them, see the same thing. They share the experience of seeing the light or seeing the person, and they'll say, that was our dad came to see us, or our mom came to see us, or some spiritual being came to see us. They'll feel the sense of light. Nurses will talk about this more often than doctors will, I've discovered. I think a lot of doctors have they have reputations. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be considered crazy and kooks and all this kind of stuff, so they're not quite so open to talk about it. But nurses, who are generally much more empathetic, because they're with the patient all the time and they see all these things, they will talk about having these experiences too. I had one such experience in a hospital. I was up here. I hadn't moved up here yet, although I was coming up and starting to build the road to come back where I was going to build the house and all that kind of stuff. And I got a call that a very good friend of mine was dying and not going to make it too much longer. He was in a hospital down back in Florida. So I immediately packed up all my stuff, got in the car, and drove right back down to Florida. I drove right to the hospital where he was, the Veterans Hospital. And his wife was there, and we were there around the bedside, and I was holding his hand, and he was fully with us. He wasn't being given drugs and all this kind of stuff, but you can tell he was fading quickly. And one of the nurses came in, and she took his other hand, and she said, "Reverend Willis, would you lead us in prayer?" Sure. So he and his wife and the nurse and me, we were all holding hands in a circle. And all of a sudden, my eyes were closed, but I could feel some kind of a presence in, like somebody just shone a quick light, a flash in front of my closed eyes. And I opened my eyes immediately and I saw the others. Their eyes were open too. And the nurse, I said, "Amen." I said, "Did you feel anything?" And the nurse said, "Yeah, he's gone. This has happened to me before." It was a shared death experience. Hmm. And it's a holy thing, a sacred thing, to share that experience with somebody who is, you know, your friend or a loved one.
Yeah.
And to be there at the moment when they pass. And I'll never forget it. And we shared his death, a shared death experience. And it was quite something.
Wow. Wow. So, Jim, as we wrap up today, I guess I would ask you this. If you're someone who maybe is questioning, and I know it's healthy to question. I'm not saying this is not a natural thing to do, but you're in the middle of your life, and this is when it tends to happen. When you're mm-hmm. you know, maybe around your 20s, 30s, 40s, you're thinking to yourself, you know, is that it? When you die, is that it? Am I just in the ground, or you know, do you really have these near-death experiences? I'm listening to the show. Do these things really happen, or is this mm-hmm. just a thing of fables? Or as people are questioning these things, how do you sit down with somebody and say, listen, there's nothing to worry about. These things happen. They're natural. They're as natural as watching the grass grow outside. They're as natural as the birds singing. How do you calm somebody's fears, and how do you get them to buy in, so to speak?
Yeah, I do it differently now than I did 20 or 30 years ago. I used to try to intellectualize it, you know, 17 good reasons why there is a life after death. You know, it doesn't work. Doesn't work. To someone who is doubting this, doubt is perfectly natural. That's one of the things you came to experience. That's why you developed an ego. That's why you developed individual. That's why you came to this material world. You're going to have doubts in this world, because in this world we react through our brains and everything else. Ignoring that is just not going to help. So what I like to tell people now is offer a prayer. And they say, well, I don't believe in, I mean, I'm not sure anything's going to hear it. I said, okay, make the prayer to whom it may concern. you know, and don't worry about it. Your job is not to answer the prayer. Your job is to throw it out there. And one of the great apostles who has been my hero down through the ages was Thomas the doubter. Mm-hmm. All the disciples had, you know, seen Jesus after the resurrection, according to this story. And Thomas said, I'm not going to believe that. I'm going to, unless I actually see it, you know, I'm not going to believe it. And all of a sudden, there, he saw and he believed. And the other person that I love, when the story about when Jesus was talking about the poor sick man, and Jesus said, you know, to pray, and he said, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. Why not, you know?
Yeah.
What have you got to lose? Throw it out there, and that puts the impetus on the Spirit to contact you. And then keep your eyes open. I've come to believe there is no such thing as coincidence, that serendipity is very real, and that if you throw this out to the universe, out to a spirit being that you may not even believe in, or you may just maybe 10% believe, but 90% don't, throw it out and say, if you're there, you know, help me through this. And then keep your eyes open. I mean, you'll be surprised. You'll turn on the television and see just the program you want. You'll put on YouTube or something and just hear just the podcast you need. I almost guarantee that somebody is listening to us talk right now who doesn't really believe. And I challenge you right now, whoever you may be, throw it out and say, is this real? And then, you know, just do the best you can with it, but don't be ashamed of not believing, and don't knock yourself for not believing. Admit the truth. Okay, you don't believe. Fine. That's not your problem. Throw it out there and see what happens. And I guarantee that there's somebody listening right now who will receive an answer. And when you do, please go to jimwillis.net. That's my webpage. Go to the contact page where you can send me an email to that contact page and tell me your experience. I want to hear from you. I really do. And I guarantee I will answer it, because I'm sure that's going to happen. Tim, people like you do great work. You are opening up these kinds of conversations to who knows who. And it doesn't matter about the numbers. I know we all do it. You know, how many people watched, or how many people, you know, all this kind of, we all do that. But the one person who needs it, that's the one you're after.
That's right. Yeah.
And I guarantee that somebody is listening, Tim, and I want to hear from you when the universe answers your call.
Absolutely. I'm curious as well. You know, I'd like to know if someone got that sign. That's what kind of tickles me is when someone gets that sign, whether it be a sign from a loved one from beyond, or whether it be that sign you finally got that that affirms what it is you're looking for. That to me, that's what kind of tickles my fancy, I guess, is the best way to put it. So the name of the book is Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys, and Revelations. It's out there right now, folks. It's available by Visible Ink Press. And again, you heard Jim's website, jimwillis.net. We'll have the link in the description of the program as well. We encourage you to check out more on Jim as well. Jim, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Tim. This has been a pleasure. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Pleasure's been all mine. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I want to thank Jim Willis for being in with us today. Aaron Deese was originally scheduled to be in the spot today. He was unable to make it today. We'll schedule him in for another day. Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys and Revelations is available right now. Folks, I encourage you to go get this book. This book is the most complete book I've ever seen when it comes to the subject of near-death experiences, death in general, and really just taking the subject of death and bringing it out of that supernatural realm and bringing it down to making it a normal part of life. And it's got this wonderful section at the end of the book. And we kind of talked about it a little bit during the program, but essentially it prepares you for the end. And it's just so neat that Jim put this in here. And it's called Epilogue, The Meaning of Life. Now, of course, I'm not going to spoil the ending for you, but it's kind of bold to put the meaning of life at the end of a book. But you have to see it for yourself. Again, pick up the book, Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys and Revelations. We have a link to it in the description of this program. I encourage you, highly encourage you to get it. Folks, coming up on the weekend, we encourage you to go out and enjoy every bit of this life and have fun with it and enjoy it. Of course, we're also here for each other, so go out and help someone this weekend as well. Spring cleanup. There's plenty of spring cleanup to do this weekend, so help someone, help one of your neighbors this weekend. With that, help yourself this weekend as well. There's lots to do out there. I'll be at the KNSI radio this weekend, so knsiradio.com from 7 to 9 a.m. on Saturday. That's Central Time. You'll have to adjust for your time zone. I'm not quite sure what it is in your time zone. But I'll be up there doing news, weather, sports, and much, much more. Let's see. What else is going on here? Oh, yes. Potographs for Pooches, May 18th at the Palmer House Hotel in Sauk Center, Minnesota. There's still a precious few tickets left for this thing. Go to darknessradioshow.com, click on the events tab, and you can get your tickets for that as well. Also, Michigan Paracon. I'll be there. You can get your tickets for that as well in the events tab there. Updating you on Beer City Bruiser. He will be back, folks. I swear to you. I don't have him locked up in a closet somewhere here or in the basement at my home. I'm not holding him hostage. We're not handcuffing him. There's nothing like that going on. But he will be back very soon. In the meantime, you go to Title Match Wrestling, and you can catch him there as part of AML. He's a champion over there, you know. So you can watch his matches on Title Match Wrestling. We have a link to Title Match Wrestling at the events page that I've just mentioned there at darknessradioshow.com. So check him out, live and in living color, doing his thing over there. So there you go. Want to thank both Mally Fox and Jessica Freeberg for filling in this week. And both of them doing a wonderful job. And by gosh, I have fun with both of them. So, and someday, yes, we'll get the both of them on one show together. We'll make it happen. But I don't know when that will be. So you can turn on the pressure, boys. I am not making that dream come true yet. So just hold your horses. Next week, big week of shows. That's all I'll say. But we're going to keep them coming here through the month of April. And we've got them coming through the month of May, too. I've got some good shows coming up here in the next few weeks. So I'm hoping you guys will like them just as much as I'm liking putting them together. I'm having a good time putting these shows together for you guys. So I hope you'll enjoy them as much as I am putting them together. So there you go. If you have a suggestion for a guest, email me, tim@darknessradio.com. If you have somebody that you'd like to hear on the show, whether it be in the true crime realm or the paranormal realm, please email me. And if you have a way to get a hold of them, maybe it's somebody that you know that you have a way to get a hold of them, even if it's a website link, include it in that email, please. All right, that'll do it for this week. Thank you so much, folks. Just one final thank you for listening, taking your hard-earned free time to listen to this show. It is greatly appreciated. I don't think I thank you enough for listening to this show and for patronizing our sponsors, but thank you so much for doing that both. And I appreciate you, Mally, Jess, Bruiser, appreciate you for continuing to listen to this program. And thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We love you. We can't thank you enough for being here with us on this journey in both our lives and continuing to listen to the best in true crime and paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.